J.C. Corcoran Podcast. Somebody released the top 10 most Googled questions about sex. Oh, don't flatter yourself. So here they are. Number 10, how long does sex last? The answer, of course, not long enough. Number 9, how to insert the male organ into a female organ? I think they may have cleaned that question up a little bit. And by the way, there's only one way in, as far as I know, and one way out, for that matter. Number 8, how old you have to be buying condoms? Depends on whether or not the guy at the drugstore believes that you have an older brother and that he's out in the car waiting. Number 7, how to measure a penis? Just remember that the next time you ask to borrow somebody's ruler. Number 5, what is the clap? Number 4, how to get rid of genital warts? Number 3, how to get rid of herpes? I see a trend developing here. Number 2, how to make a woman climax. Well, how do you not know that? I mean, don't you watch The Simpsons, for God's sake?
Oh, Homer!
Yeah. Oh, Marge. Oh, Marge. Oh, Marjorie. Oh, yeah.
Okay. All right. That's enough. I'm throwing up in my mouth a little bit. And number 1, where is the G-spot? Well, that's easy. It's right between the F and the H spot.
No, I'm just getting warmed up.
Happy to see you again.
Don't be nervous. Don't be rocky. You're a teenage guest is jockey now.
And let me begin by wishing you a beautiful look.
Did that voice inside you say, I've heard it all before? It's like deja vu.
It is Thursday, May 20th, 2021, and it's the J.C. Corcoran Podcast. How you doing, kids? I just spent about 10 minutes sneezing right before we posted this whole thing. Allergies. You know, I never had allergies until I moved to St. Louis. I was fine. I got to St. Louis when I was, I think, 31. Allergies are just annoying. They also will hit you where it hurts. New poll found 49% of Americans suffer from seasonal allergies. That's half the population. And over the course of your life, you will spend more than $16,000 dealing with your allergies. Average person with allergies spends $266 a year on pills and other treatments. That's about $22 a month, or $16,000 over the course of your life if you live to the average age of 78. 36% of people say their allergies have been worse this year, 26% said better, and 39% said about the same. That poll, by the way, also found almost half the people have confused their allergy symptoms with COVID since the pandemic started. Salma Hayek, the latest celebrity to step forward and say that she almost checked out with COVID. I guess her doctor said, you got to get to the hospital, and she said, no, I'd rather die at home. Sort of a defeatist attitude about things, but she's better, and she said it was a close call. This story, you know, sometimes you leave the room. You leave the room when you got to pass gas, okay? For obvious reasons. This guy farted so loud, his neighbors across the street heard it. They sent a text to his wife to check their doorbell cam. And sure enough, it showed up across the street. The hell did that guy eat? The entertainment world distressed over the Friends trailer, which has been released. Matthew Perry seemed very off, slouching, sort of a vacant stare. And when he spoke, he seemed very lethargic, and his speech was slurred. By the way, not everything you see on TV is real. Newsflash. I was just making jokes about Detroit the other day, and that's number one on the list. Detroit, not dying, not decaying, not falling apart. There's a lot of renewal and revitalization in recent years. Visitors are often surprised how not run down downtown Detroit is. The Las Vegas economy is not based on gambling and tourism, that's all. Vegas has been diversifying its economy into areas like healthcare and infrastructure and has grown in popularity as a location for corporate headquarters. People always say it's sunny and dry in Miami, and it is not. It has a tropical monsoon climate with a pretty serious rainy season, and it is not a coincidence the University of Miami is the home of the Hurricanes. People say everybody in New York travels by taxi. Most people use public transportation, buses, trains. A lot of people are under the impression that in L.A., everybody goes to the beach all the time. The beaches are popular tourist attractions, but the locals don't really go very often. Dallas is not just cattle and oil fields. In fact, oil and gas are only the fifth largest part of the economy behind finance and manufacturing. Chicago and the Windy City has nothing to do with the amount of wind. It came from a 19th century newspaper editorial criticizing city officials for being full of hot air, thus the Windy City. If you remember the 1980s movie Roger and Me, which was the very first Michael Moore movie, and damned funny and very entertaining, by the way. How about this? In 1998, a 22-year-old guy by the name of David Seth Cohen was working as a production assistant on Adam Sandler's movie Big Daddy. So Adam invited David back to his apartment for a drink, but David declined because he was still on the clock. Well, apparently he's regretted it ever since. He thinks it might have even changed his life. Here's the quote. "This was my opportunity to get into the inner circle of a comedy legend. Adam helps out people he likes and always works with his friends," end quote. Well, this guy David never stopped obsessing over this, and in 2006, he started making a movie called Finding Sandler, where he documents his attempt to finally have that drink with Adam and jumpstart his film career in the process. David claims Adam's team has been ducking him for years, and Adam's manager even called him in 2007 and suggested he give it up, but Adam's rep said that never even happened. And speaking of TV, Mariska Hargitay has a broken knee, a hairline fracture in her ankle, and a torn ligament. She didn't say how it happened, but she said it didn't happen at work. Keep in mind, she's living on borrowed time anyhow because she was in the back seat, as you know, when her mom crashed the car and was killed way back in the, well, I guess it was the 1960s. In Los Angeles right now, they are having these things they have every year called the Upfronts. The Upfronts. Where all the networks invite all of the media to Los Angeles, and they put on a big show where they reveal what new shows are coming to the fall lineup and which shows are returning and stuff like that. CBS had theirs the other day. NCIS Hawaii will return. Survivor, CSI Vegas, William Peterson, all those people. Also, they're going to get into the Hallmark business. I mean, sort of. Two Hallmark-style romantic Christmas movies. Late night tonight, Jimmy Fallon's got Tina Fey and Mo Rocca, Counting Crows on with Kimmel. Colbert's got John Krasinski. Hank Azaria on with James Corden. Seth Meyers has two people I've never heard of before. And Bill Burr, arguably the funniest stand-up comic working right now, is on with Conan. I don't know how old Jackson Brown is right now, but my guess is somewhere in his early 70s. And he just released his first ever music video to include cannibalism. The song is called My Cleveland Heart, and the plot revolves around Jackson getting a heart transplant. His band plays the doctors, by the way. They remove the heart and replace it with some sort of metal contraption. The old heart is then given to a nurse who takes a bite out of it. Now, we don't actually see her do that. The video isn't that graphic. What we do see, though, is the nurse holding the heart with a little bit of blood dripping from the corner of her mouth. I mean, you certainly get the point. Jackson Brown, here's the quote. "I thought it was really appropriate to take out my worn-out, useless heart and hand it to the nurse. Who better to hand it to than somebody young, strong, and possibly as cynical as me," end quote. I have no idea what the hell that's supposed to mean. I have two very, very odd Jackson Brown stories to tell you. All right, so this was in the late 80s, and Jackson Brown played the Fox Theater, and there was like a little meet and greet after the show. Most of the time they do those things before, but for some reason this was after the show. I had been working with his road manager. His road manager's name was Buddha. Everybody just called him Buddha. So I called him Buddha too. He hands me a business card, and on the fucking business card, it says Buddha. And so we're backstage after the show, and, you know, Jackson's walking around, just shaking hands, talking to people. We have a little bit of an exchange, and Buddha is standing right next to him. Buddha, by the way, I would say was about maybe 6'5" and very wide, but he looked agile. So we're just chit-chatting about this, that, and the other thing. But at one point, I sort of pulled him a little bit closer, and I just said to him, you know, I just want to thank you for this song that he had just done called In the Shape of a Heart. And if you know the song, you know, it's about a broken love affair and there's like a little piece of jewelry, like a neck chain with a heart on it. And the story goes into this whole thing about In the Shape of a Heart. And I say to him, you know, I just think that was a remarkable song. And at that point, Buddha looks at Jackson Brown. Jackson Brown looks at Buddha, and the two of them just walk away from me. I've been trying to figure that one out for almost 30 years. Now, fast forward a couple of years later, and Jackson Brown's record company is mad because Keishi won't play the latest Jackson Brown song. And they get really, really pissed off. So they come to us at KSD, the classic rock station in 93.7 back in the day, and where we used to do, you know, the Breakfast Club every morning. And they call me up, and basically what they say is that they want to get into Keishi's knickers. You know, they want to piss him off. So they say, here's what we'll do. We'll fly you to Chicago. Jackson Brown is going to be doing a show next week in Chicago. We'll fly you up there. You bring your TV crew along, and we'll give you an exclusive one-on-one interview with Jackson Brown. And I'm like, yeah, that's fun. Sure, I'll do that. So we fly up there. We get there about 10 o'clock in the morning. Keep in mind, now this show is, I don't know, maybe 7 o'clock that night. But it was short notice, and we had to get, you know, whatever flight we could get. So, you know, by the time we landed at O'Hare, we got a car. We headed to the concert venue in northwest suburban Chicago in the suburbs there. And we sat down in this little room. I think we got there maybe 11 o'clock in the morning, actually got there and set up, and we're waiting. And we're told that Jackson Brown is going to be doing a sound check at some point, and we can videotape part of the sound check, and then he'll come back into our little room here and we'll do the interview. So now it's noon, now it's 1, now it's 2, now it's 3. No interview, no Jackson Brown, no nothing. We've been sitting there for hours. Now about 3 o'clock, things seem to be picking up a little bit, and I notice some movement out in the hallway, and sure enough, going right past our open door, I see Jackson Brown, and he looks over his shoulder into the room and sees us there, but he keeps going. The next thing we hear is a guy comes in and goes, get your gear and let's go. Like, okay, my cameraman and I, we get up and we head and we head back out into the concert venue, and they said you can set up right here, which was about halfway back in the pavilion. And they're like, all right, set up right here. Do not record anything until we tell you to. I'm like, that's fine. You know, they don't want to get video. They don't want us to get video of Jackson Brown picking his nose or something. They're like, don't shoot anything until we tell you to. Okay, fine, we won't. Another guy comes back. Do not shoot anything until we tell. Yeah, we know, we know. I told the cameraman, step away from the camera so they know we're not shooting. All right. So we're standing there, and Jackson Brown and the band come out, and there's a little bit of noise, and they're tuning up, and they 1, 2, 3, 4, and they start playing Running on Empty. And we're standing there, we're watching, and we're listening, and it's all cool. And about, I don't know, 2 minutes into the song, keep in mind it's a sound check, it's a rehearsal. They don't, you know, necessarily do the whole song. Jackson Brown stops right in the middle of the song and addresses us from the stage and says, all right, is that enough? Did you get what you need? And I yell back to him, we're not shooting. And he says, tell me that was a joke. And I'm looking around like, where are the guys who told us not to shoot? They're nowhere to be found. And we're like, we were told not to shoot until we got an explicit direct okay. And he's looking really, really pissed off about this. And so they're like, all right, start shooting. And then they play Running on Empty again. And we shoot like 2 minutes of it. And then they stop. And they're like, okay, that's enough. And now we go back to the interview room backstage and we wait. It's now 4 o'clock. Keep in mind, our flight is at 7 out of O'Hare, and we wait, and now it's 5 o'clock. And finally, Jackson Brown comes around the corner and sits down and says, you ready to go? Let's go. Got a great interview out of it, made it to the airport just in time, and I later learned that Jackson Brown that day had been having a big fight with Daryl Hannah, who he was still seeing at the time. She's from Chicago, and apparently she was at her parents' house, and he was like trying to track her down all day, trying to call her. They were having troubles communicating. I guess they were having a fight, the whole thing. And then apparently I sat there from, from 10 o'clock in the morning until 6. For those of you keeping score at home, that is 8 hours. But we did get a great interview out of it. Ah, the glamour of show business. And now this.
Last week, a group of former U.S. military leaders signed a bizarre open letter pushing election lies. It's kind of spooky. Military guys putting out a letter saying the election was stolen is the kind of thing that happens right before the junta starts buying mirrored sunglasses. But as shocking as this letter is, was, am, I was heartened by the name of one former military patriot who signed the letter, Rear Admiral Jack Mehoff. Jack Mehoff is a true American hero who served bravely in several solo missions where he beat off the enemy single-handedly. We all remember his heroics at the Battle of Strokinawa. Lost a lot of good seamen that day. He was awarded the Purple Heart on, at which point he wasn't honorably discharged. He was fully released. Battle of the Bulge. Jack Mehoff is, I am just now realizing, a made-up name submitted by someone trying to prank these stupid retired fascists. But they didn't catch on. Instead, they published the name. After responding, thank you for your support. Your name will be added to the letter today. Thank you for standing tall. Yes! Rear Admiral Jack Mehoff stands tall, especially if he takes a certain medication 3 to 5 hours before he thinks he might need to salute. And this hero is following in the footsteps of great American pranksters. The Declaration of Independence is full of signatures like Beat Your Meat, Finger Blaster, and of course, John Hancock. And I want to take this moment to call on all members of the military, whether you're currently in action or having some orange juice before your next call of duty, to sign this letter using your definitely real name. I'm talking to you, Major Hardin. Captain, look at these balls. Sergeant Ruben Juanout. Colonel Ann L. Beads. Private Willie Tugger. And of course, Field Marshal Buttstuff. Thank you for your self-service.
Out of all the guys trying to make the transition from a live audience to no audience, Colbert has done it better than anybody. But you got to believe, you know, you're hearing all these stories about things going back to normal and full capacity at sporting events. It can't be that much longer before the networks allow studio audiences back at their shows. I mean, that's got to be coming pretty soon. All right, today is a weird anniversary. Back in 1969, Peter Cetera from Chicago is watching a Cubs-Dodgers game at Chavez Ravine, Dodger Stadium in Los Angeles. And seated behind him were four Marines who got loaded, got really liquored up, thought that Peter Cetera's hair was too long, had no idea that he was the lead singer for Chicago. And words were exchanged. The next thing you know, four Marines are beating the living shit out of Peter Cetera of Chicago. And they broke a bunch of bones in his face. Peter Cetera's jaw was broken. He had his mouth wired shut for 3 months. I told this story before when the Cardinals won the World Series in 2011. It's maybe an hour after the game. People have been celebrating in the streets. And I'm in one of those, five-level parking garages a couple of blocks north of Busch Stadium. And I'm sitting up there, and the traffic is not moving. You know, you're just sitting there. You're on a ramp, and nobody's moving. There's gridlock downstairs, and you just got to sit there and wait it out. And the cars are all lined up there. Nobody's going anywhere. And all of a sudden, I hear this crunching noise, and my car moves. And I get out, and I look, and four guys in an SUV had this idea that somehow they were going to pull around in front of me. Keep in mind, I'm on a ramp. There's nowhere to go. Get out of the car. It's four Illinois state troopers drunk off their asses. I don't know what this guy was even thinking. There's nowhere to go. You can't we're in a parking garage. He's going to go around me. I'm so sure. And they sort of begged me not to report it to the police. because, man, were they liquored up. If the cops showed up, well, you know, what do you do now? You bring the St. Louis police in, and there's four drunken Illinois state troopers in the car behind me, and I got a busted up car. And not wanting to run afoul of the law, I went along with their plan, and they just wrote me a check, and that was the end of that. Anyhow, I never got a chance to talk to Peter Cetera about this, but I did have a chance to talk about that and lots of things with Robert Lamb of Chicago, one of the original members of the band, and our JC Celebrity A-List interview of the day. Don't you ever worry when you see what's going down. Well, I'm trying to mind my business. That is no business at all.
Well, when you start talking about great stuff, you are talking Chicago, and they will be here on Wednesday night at the fabulous Fox Theater. And one of the guys who was there right from the beginning in 1967, Robert Lamb, joins us. How are you doing this morning?
Hey, good morning. How are you guys?
Great to have you here. Let's start right there, because I'm going to tell you something. That song got a lot of new life during the campaign and the subsequent election last fall. I can't tell you how many times I played that song and said, my God, this song is 30 years old, and it's almost as if it was written for the election that we are facing today, with all the sort of class warfare and the stuff going on college campuses, where it's seem to be divided between the sort of liberally minded people and the young Republicans all on campus, and the great divide. What do you remember about the first life and what appears to have been a second life for that particular song?
Well, actually, it may have been the third or fourth life of
really?
That song. Because virtually every time, I can distinctly remember being on tour sometime around the Clinton era, you know, and actually we hadn't done that song for a while. We threw it back into the set, and people would come up to me and say, man, it sounds like nothing's changed.
Yeah.
You know, it's like the old adage, you know, the more things change, the more they stay the same.
Sure.
And, you know, who knew? But when I, you know, obviously I wrote that in the early 70s. We were still in the midst of the Vietnam War. We were still struggling with civil rights. You know, there was still student unrest on campuses. You know, the whole nine yards was going on then, and that's why I wrote that.
Mm-hmm. Are you most proud of that song of all your songs?
I'd have to say it's up there. You know, I have different criteria, but you know, that's a song. I have to tell you, that's a song that I wrote while I was sleeping and dreaming, because I have never done that since. But
what do you mean you wrote it when you were sleeping and dreaming?
I was on the road somewhere, and I woke up very early in the morning, and I had the whole song in my head, and I grabbed a pencil and a piece of paper out of the hotel drawer, and I basically had the structure of the song.
See, that's very rare, because anybody who's ever tried to do that before, usually you get up and you start writing gibberish, and it made sense during the dream, and then you're like, what the hell am I writing here?
Exactly.
That's a very rare situation there.
You know, or I've just rewritten a Beatles song.
Yeah. I got to tell you something. As a kid growing up on the south side of Chicago, not far from where Styx sort of made their mark over there in you know, St. Lawrence High School, which was my place, I got to remember, you know, when I was in college at Northern Illinois University, if you didn't have tickets for one of what I think was about 12 shows that you guys used to do over the Thanksgiving holiday at Chicago's Airy Crown Theater at McCormick Place, you just didn't count. You might as well have just checked out of civilization. A lot of cities have traditions, music-related traditions, you know, different time periods and stuff like that. But that was one of the greatest memories I ever have of you guys doing all of those shows over the Thanksgiving vacation.
Well, you know, in those days, there were. It was still only a few years since we had left Chicago to go to the West Coast and record, and, you know, great things happen. So we try to make it a point to get back to the city around Thanksgiving so we could see our families and that whole thing. So that was sort of part of the logic of playing during Thanksgiving in Chicago for several years.
Yeah, and those very early days of Chicago, you know, brings up sort of a conundrum for you guys, because I don't know, is this a difficult thing for you guys to do, to try to satisfy the old crowd who probably saw Chicago as more of a rock act with CTA and maybe the first two or three albums, as opposed to the subsequent albums, which went a little more pop? When you guys are doing those shows, I mean, you're sort of caught in the middle there. How do you do that?
Well, you know, it's probably tougher on us than than you might imagine. Although, you know, we've sort of come to grips with the fact that, you know, it's a very wide spectrum of people who come to Chicago concerts. You know, the music business has changed. You know, we don't, you know, we're not selling records. We're not on the radio all the time with our newest stuff because the classic stuff is on all the time. Thank God. But, you know, we play all over the world. And as I say, it's a very broad swatch of audience that comes to see us play. So we get some satisfaction from that. But if you ask each individual guy what they would rather be playing, I think it's probably, you know, the harder stuff.
Yeah, because when I saw you guys the last time here in St. Louis outdoors at the Verizon Wireless Amphitheater, about two-thirds of the way through the show, I was shocked when you guys did Ballet for a Girl from Buchanan, because I was like, oh, well, see, now we're talking. But I didn't expect it.
Yeah. Well, you know, that's another thing. You know, a couple of us are always sort of pushing to add new twists into the concert. And actually, the show that we play in St. Louis at the Fox, we're doing a pretty interesting lineup of songs that are, a lot of them are kind of harder edge than you would expect. We're doing The Stone of Sisyphus from the album that finally came out last year. And that's about as tough a song as anything you'd find on the early albums. We are doing the ballet. We're also doing things from the 80s, but not necessarily the ballads. We're doing things like Along Comes a Woman and Stay the Night, which are a little tougher edge. So, you know, we're sort of in that mood, you know, where we don't want to play a whole lot of ballads, but we still have to play a certain number of them.
Mm-hmm. We're talking with Robert Lamb, one of the founding members of Chicago. Here's Laurie Mack. Laurie.
And this, I have to apologize, this may be the dumbest, this may be the dumbest question you're ever going to get asked, but when I, my husband and I, when we sing Chicago lyrics, it seems like time comes up a lot in the lyrics. The easy examples are 25 or 6 to 4. Does anybody really know what time it is? Is that something that you were thinking about a lot when you were writing these songs? Was it just a coincidence? I guess I'm just wondering if, you know, like Shakespeare seemed to have an obsession with time when he wrote, and I just wondered if it was something that was conscious in
you? Let me say this first, that's not the dumbest question.
That's a relief.
It's actually a pretty good question.
The dumbest question is, are you going to do Stairway to Heaven Wednesday night?
Well, actually, you know, time is something that, you know, I have thought about and I think about a lot. You know, quite honestly, it was a way for me not to have to write about what I was really feeling.
Mm. Huh. Defense mechanism, Robert Lamb. Yeah. Oh, we're on Oprah here all of a sudden.
You know, and I have actually moved beyond that, and I actually sort of dealt with that aspect of my writing in the last maybe 10 years or so, and fortunately for Chicago, it was all mostly on my solo work. So, but time was something that I could sort of intellectually kind of play with, and it came out in the songs that you mentioned.
Robert, from time to time, obviously, the music business changes dramatically, and all of a sudden, a band with a lot of horns just completely falls out of favor, just goes out of style. When the music business has made those turns, and it's probably made three or four of them since the band's inception in 1967, how did you guys handle it? Did you just sort of throw in the towel and go, well, look, we're just going to play to our fans, but we just can't gain any ground right now. We'll wait for the cyclical fashion of the record business to come back around and we'll be popular again, or am I overthinking this?
No, I mean, thoughts like that were very prevalent, especially I would say during the 80s, and you know, and we were trying to survive the death of Terry Kath, and later on the departure of Peter Cetera. So we were doing everything we could to stay together as a band, and you know, keep recording, keep engaged in the music, continue to tour. So you know, there were a number of albums we did in that span that, you know, there were no horns on some of the cuts, some of the tracks. But of course, you know, in a live situation, when we played those songs, we tried to find something else for those guys to do. You know, so you had Jimmy Panko over there playing a second or third keyboard. You had Walter picking up a guitar and playing it, even though he doesn't play it very well. So you know, we tried to sort of adapt, you know, on the fly. But at some point, we all looked at each other and said, "What the hell are we doing?" So. So eventually, yeah, we just said, you know, we just got to stay as true to ourselves as we possibly can be. So what are our strengths? Our strengths are songwriting. Our strengths are a great horn section. Our strengths are, you know, we have several very good singers in the band. So let's just concentrate on that. And so, you know, there was a definite manifesto towards the end of the 80s where we said, that's it, you know, there's going to be horns. There's horns in the band. There's going to be horns on these songs, and we'll try to work it in an interesting way.
Have a great time on stage at the Fox Theater Wednesday night. Robert Lamb of Chicago, thanks for spending a little time with us on the air here in St. Louis. All right, okay. Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
And with that, another J.C. Corcoran podcast here at jconline.com is in the can. We publish at 7 o'clock every weekday morning, but you can download it, listen whenever you please. And continue to spread the word, if you will, that we are here doing this podcast so that more people find out about it. To follow me on Facebook, The Showgram with J.C. Corcoran. My email is jc@jconline.com. And we'll be back tomorrow morning, bright and early. Enjoy your day. In the meantime, we've beaten this one to death. Have a good one. See you later. Bye.
The J.C. Corcoran Podcast.